intentions battle, connotation because neither of you was respecting all of the other. There is a great deal more to a person than intellect and genitals. The omission was the soul, closed bracket. Sorry, I didn't tell you, Doug. The mic's yours.
Okay, I was wondering if you dropped it or if you just had a net split or something. Okay, this pair of paragraphs really are quite interesting. And obviously, they're not directly intended to be part of the course. But a commentary or discussion between Helen and Jesus about an experience she had with a colleague in which their professional enthusiasm for complex factorial analysis of covariance kind of got them both a little horny, I guess you might say. And this incident is being used to illustrate one kind of level confusion, the confusion of the soul with the body, or the bodily level of our being in the soul level. And the other being the confusion between, this is really interesting, the confusion between sex and aggression. Now, not very many people could be confused as to which is which, and yet the two do tend to be confused or conflated often in human experience, which leads to a kind of battle of the sexes. How often have we heard that? Which is a result, here we're being told by Jesus, because neither of you is respecting all of the other. There's a great deal more to a person than just his intellect and genitals. What was omitted was the soul. And Teddy is writing here. Yeah, I said soul. I'm reading what Teddy is writing. Teddy, if you want to talk, stick your hand up. I'm going to read what Teddy has written because I think it's interesting. Notice, too, in addition to using the word soul, Teddy writes, he uses a positive descriptive word when he mentions the quality of intellect. Yes. He says both good ones, by the way. Apparently, Jesus doesn't think anything is wrong with the intellect. Jesus actually tells us to use our intellects and our reasoning powers quite often and makes a direct pitch to reason, think it out, Helen. and it must not actually get in the way. Yeah, there's a lot of anti-intellectualism running around in the world, and the idea that we must turn our brains off in order to understand anything, which in certain times and places is probably relevant, that one must still one's thinking sometimes to recognize anything. But at other times, the thinking ability we have is absolutely crucial to sort of falsehood. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about those two. And this theme continues in the next paragraphs and is expanded by Jesus. Again, he uses this example to raise the question of ends and means. And we're now at the top of page 35, and Deborah has just posted the link, which you may need to cut and paste into your browser. It doesn't always work from clicking here for some reason. Okay, Deborah, take it away.
Gee, I take 1 week off and forget to announce what paragraph I'm reading, so I'll do that on each paragraph. That will help to keep everybody to the spot where we're actually reading. So, 37AA. I submit, bracket, after a long interruption, bracket, that if a mind, in brackets, soul, is invalid relation. It can't be upside down. Jack and the other very eminent methodologists have abandoned validity in favor of reliability because they have lost sight of the end and are concentrating on the means. I never equated mind and soul. Here you go, Doug.
Well, this is interesting because Helen initially writes mind and then bracket soul, and I should check the notes on that particular variation. I believe that's actually the way it's written in the notes, so this is an accurate transcription here. And I can only conclude initially that kind of notation indicates Helen is uncertain as to exactly what word is appropriate. And it would seem to me that soul here is probably the more relevant, but the point I was most wanting to draw attention to is the second sentence. Jack and other very eminent methodologists have abandoned validity in favor of reliability because they have lost sight of the end and are concentrating on the means. This is a chronic problem in the social sciences, generally, where the effort is under the necessity in social scientific research is to come up with, or the perceived necessity, I should say, come up with valid testing devices, valid ways of testing. Not valid, reliable ways of testing. Because so much of social scientific research is rather subjective, and the reliability of the data is often highly questionable. In the search for reliability, which is itself a necessary means, the end, the goal, which is validity, that your data actually means something, is often lost sight of. And then we get into the story, the example of the artist who spent his whole life sharpening pencils, which are the means, and never got to making the drawing, which was the end to which the pencils were the means. And this discussion of validity and reliability continues for some time and is actually quite, I think, quite relevant to the spiritual seeker in a variety of ways. Okay, so that was the first paragraph on page 35. We're now on to T1B 37AB. Take it away, Deborah.
37AB. By the way, I left the room and came back in, so hopefully I'll be able to see everyone when they post. So 37AB, remember the story about the artist who kept devoting himself to inventing better and better ways of sharpening pencils. He never created anything, but he had the sharpest pencils in town. Bracket, the language here is intentional. Sex is often utilized on behalf of very similar errors. Hostility, triumph, vengeance, self-debasement, and all sorts of expressions of the lack of love are often very clearly seen in the accompanying fantasies. But it is a profound error to imagine that because these fantasies are so frequent, bracket, or occur so reliably, close bracket, that this implies validity. Remember that while validity implies reliability, the relationship is not reversible. You can be wholly reliable and entirely wrong. 37AC. While a reliable test does measure something, what use is the test unless you discover what that, this in brackets, something is? And if validity is more important than reliability and is also necessarily implied by it, why not concentrate on validity and let reliability fall naturally into place? 37AD. Intellect may be a displacement upward, that's in quotations, but sex can be a, in quotations, displacement outward. How can man, in quotations, come close to others through the parts of him which are really invisible? The word, in quotations, invisible means quotation cannot be seen or perceived, close quotation. We're on page 36 now. What cannot be perceived is hardly the right means for improving perception. Here's the mic, Doug.
Okay. I'm just going to respond to TB's, is that Maria? What teacher are you listening to, Marie? We're reading the text of A Course in Miracles right now, to which has been added material from the shorthand notes, where it is significantly different from that in the text. For the most part, the notes in the text are pretty much the same, but there are a few points where there's material in the notes that's not in the and it's been added to this document. And I'm going to post the link again. And if you cut... Yes, I can see what you're writing. It wasn't an answer, it was a question. It wasn't a question, it was an answer. Okay. All right, I thought it was a question. All right, so, anyways, that's what we're reading from here for anybody who didn't know. And yeah, I do have a hard time reading everything that's running through quickly. Yes, I understand now it was a rhetorical comment. Okay, what was I going to say about displacement? Displacement upward. Okay, intellect may be a displacement upward, but sex can be a displacement outward. Now, I would really love to understand how Helen, or to know how Helen understood this particular use of the word displacement, because it sounds to me a little bit like it's used as psychological jargon and has a particular meaning about ego displacement or personality displacement or something like that, and I'm not really competent to comment on that. But then the explanation is somewhat offered. How can man come close to others through the parts of him which are really invisible? The word invisible means cannot be seen or perceived. And my understanding of that is genitals, that normally our genitals are covered or can't be seen. And so how can they be used to actually... is how I understand the statement. It may mean something entirely different. And if somebody has any thoughts to offer on that, I'm all ears. But what cannot be perceived is hardly the right means for improving perception, is how that one ends. And then we get into the confusion of miracle and sexual impulses again. Teddy offers invisible meaning, not actually related to vision, spiritual sight. Okay, so we are now on page 36, top of page 36, which is paragraph T1B37AE in the text. And, oh, we've got hands up here. Okay, whoever was first, take it away.
Well, what I'm getting from this is that so often the two ways that there seems to be a displacement where people attempt to find that closeness with another person are through two ways. One is through sex, and one is through the intellect. And so by trying to get close through sex, a false sense of closeness, which I myself have definitely done in my life, or the intellect, where identifying with another person's thought or ideas or something, and keep going higher and higher with that, that those two things can create a false sense of closeness, but not be coming from the spirit, the Holy Spirit. So for that real closeness. And so I'm almost thinking that he's even talking about the special connection instead of the holy connection from that.
Tibbs, I forget who you are, but your hand is still up. Were you wanting the mic?
Yeah, I'm just going to go along with what Lisa is saying, absolutely. And if you really can see their experience, I mean, I just feel like, like how can you not know Helen and Bill personally if you've ever really been honest with yourself or have ever had a relationship? I mean, and remember, the Helen is a psychologist, and displacement is a term in psychology, and through the course, it is projection, as you know, as you're going to get through projection throughout the course, and that's not just anger, you know, it's often through the course, or just coming to the course, people think of projection as anger, but it's not just that. It is, you know, everything of the little self. And when she talks about, I don't have the text in front of me, but she, I do recall reading that it says sex can sometimes. Okay, and that's the misuse of sex, that it can, I mean, have you ever heard of like makeup sex, you know, there's all kinds of things, if you just, anyone can look honestly at themselves, and yeah, in and see all the misuses of sex. And there was one other thought that went with this. Oh, I mean, is that what you're saying is in the text? Is Doug, are you typing that, or is that, because I don't recall. Are you typing that? Okay. Yeah, you're just sharing. The other thing was really look at their relationship. She and Bill were like intellectually, like right there with each other, and probably sexually also. And I think what Helen came to, the only way out was to forgive the SOB, truly. In the end, you know, where it's the attraction was definitely there on a lot of levels, and you can't quite pinpoint that, but it's just there. But anyway, here's the mic. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you for those comments. Yeah, that displacement as roughly equivalent to projection would make sense. In that sense, intellect may be a projection upward to the head, I suppose. But sex can be, and it is, does say can be, doesn't say must be, a displacement or projection outward to others. External, those perceived as external. Yeah, Carmen, extension and projection are distinguished later in the course, with extension being sort of the divine kind of projection, and projection being more used for what the ego does to literally hurl misperceptions onto things perceived, misperceived as external, particularly guilt, in order to disown the reality of oneself. A projection outward, or are you just happy to see me? Yeah. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Marie, you've got your hand up again. Take it away.
I find it really interesting. Yeah, that was the can be, that what is being said here is intellect maybe, but sex can be. And there's really clearly a sorting. And this is probably why Helen did not want this published early on, because this is really her personally. There's really a sorting going on here. This is her awakening. It truly is. It's beautiful, and it truly is. It is her awakening and her sorting of, or looking at what isn't bringing her peace. It really is quite beautiful. Thanks for letting me share.
Well, I would echo those thoughts, Marie, that Helen and Bill both probably felt this was just too personal and too sexual for public opinion in the late 1960s. When they were editing this material, which was sort of the beginning of the sexual revolution, the very beginning of the sexual revolution, and it was, I could well see them thinking that this is too personal, it's my stuff, it's not public stuff, and B, the entire topic, even if it could be depersonalized, just might make the material seem publicly unacceptable. Just push too many buttons of too many people, so better just leave that out for now. From our perspective, looking at it some 40 years later, 30 years later, 35 years later, with both of the individuals involved being long deceased, I think the concern about making the material public is long gone. There's nobody left to be embarrassed by it, and I think Western culture is not likely to be too spooked or freaked out by this kind of discussion of what's really pretty tame sexual experience. Now, for anybody who's not aware, we're at the top of page 36 in the combined Urtext shorthand notes document, which I'm going to paste the URL for it again. Oops, that's not the URL, that's a quote. I will get the URL, copy, paste. And you may have to cut and paste that into your browser. It may not work if you click on it directly. Am I not loud enough for you, Teddy? Or anybody else? No. Okay. Jeez. I'm having some microphone issues lately. Okay, I'll shout. All right, Deborah. Usually it's Deborah the one who's fading out and I'm too loud. Okay. All right. Too low. All right. Okay, Deborah, take it away.
Well, it's interesting that I can hear you fine. You're very loud to my ears. So, and if I'm not, I mean, if you aren't loud to others, people, am I loud enough? Can you hear me? Sounds like it's not all. I have to wait a minute because there's such a delay on my board. So can someone let me know if they hear me well enough or I'm too quiet? Maybe you can't hear me at all right now. You can hear me okay. Okay, I wanted to add something in here in 37 AD, what was going through my mind when others were talking and bringing up things was also the experience that Byron Katie had when in her, she's in this state, as probably everyone in the room knows about Byron Katie, in this state where she never gets a negative thought, but she's very open to it after she had an enlightening experience. And she said that when her and Stephen married and they made love, she says it was like God making love to God. So that tells me that there's probably a deeper connection going on with that in her state than without that. So sex standing on its own, I think, is what they're really addressing here, because we can, anything can bring two people together. And if their minds are in the same place or their minds are open, they're joining minds on some level. It's not because they're joining bodies on that level or having sex that a joining may happen, but the joining can happen because their minds would be open to it and they're together at the same time. So I just wanted to add that in. It came up in reading last night in the pamphlet for psychotherapy. So it was timely. The most important sex organ is the mind. Aha. In Catholicism, original sin equals sex. I didn't realize the original sin was equated to sex. I thought it was equated to being born. Doug, take it away.
Okay, I just switched mics. I'm just wanting feedback on whether this is in any way any better. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. If somebody can tell me if that's worse, Cliff. Oh, dear. It's good, Doug, says Carmen. I hear you fine still, says Deborah. It sounds good. Same volume, but sounds like inside a tin can. Right. Okay, same volume. Thank you. Okay, in Catholicism, sex equals original sin. Well, you'd think so, the way most Catholics teach it, though actually Catholic doctrine doesn't say it's sex, as I understand Catholic doctrine, but the way most Catholics seem to understand it, it's, sin. Okay, excellent sound now. All right, I'm using two microphones, both plugged into the same jack. That might be part of the problem. Okay, to just being born, you're right. Women are daughters of Eve and the source of sin, but women are not, entirely, wholly, only, or exclusively sexual beings, you know, Carmen? I guess maybe you know that. So the fact that it's women doesn't necessarily mean that it's sex. Anyways. Oh, we've got hands up again. All right. Go for it, ladies.
Excuse me. This is very interesting. I haven't thought about original sin in a long time. So I asked myself, because I was raised Catholic, to recall. And, you know, I was saying earlier today that there are many things within Catholicism that I was raised with that had no meaning to me. And now it's like they're like coming back into my mind and I'm seeing them in a holy way. Well, that's the shift. And so I just asked myself, I said, okay, so what did my mother tell me about original sin? Forget what the nun said. Mom was a wonderful teacher. But that basically that it was a sacrament until you could make the decision for yourself, because in Catholicism you also have confirmation, and confirmation is basically your decision for God. It's supposed to be your decision for God. That's the simplest understanding of confirmation. And my mom had said, that basically, it was your parents deciding for you until you were old enough to make the decision for yourself. And then there was another thing in there also. And there are many Christian denominations that have baptism in the same way as confirmation, that it's an act of choice. But the it's very interesting about this whole thing with protection of the soul, that the parent making the choice for the child, it's believed to be a protection of the soul until they could make the choice for themselves. Yes, all Christians, they have the baptism, but I think that some have it at the time, like that teenage age. And matter of fact, even non-Christian denominations have like these, times of passage when the choice is made. But I think that some think that the original sin was about sex, is because of the words about, and then they noticed they were naked. Here's the mic. Thanks.
Okay, I hope you can hear me. They don't state it outright that sin, that original sin is sex, but if you look at the context of the entire original sin, the way it's portrayed in the Catholic Church, it is related to sex, because that's the reason why Jesus had to be born of a virgin, and that's why they went to the extreme of even making Mary herself, the mother of Jesus, the result of an immaculate conception. Jesus not only couldn't have sex himself, that's why you had such a violent reaction to the Da Vinci Code, because that would have meant that he was participating at a human level. His mother had to be born without the use of sex, so that he would have been in a pure body while he was gestating. I mean, it's really extreme. You also have to take into consideration that for approximately 300 years, there were arguments within the church fathers, collectively, about whether or not women even had souls. And that really didn't come to an end until they had to create the cult of Mary, Mother Mary, because they were having difficulty converting women to Christianity because of this really low regard for the position of women as a result of being the source of sin. And so they were having extreme difficulties in the early church getting women to go along with converting to Christianity. So they gave them a figurehead, a female figurehead, in the form of Mother Mary, to help them to extend Christianity into areas where the Mother Goddess was the main deity. So you have this emphasis on celibacy for priests because of the holiness. It's an approximation. It's the closest way of getting back to the sinless state is to swear off sex. That's why the glorification of virginity throughout Christianity. It is never said specifically that it is about sex, but if you look at all of the context, it is, in essence, that women are the source of all evil and sex, and that's because of sex. And that, dear ladies, is a pure projection, as far as I'm concerned, by the men who are much more sex than most women that I know. And that's a generalization, and I'm sorry. But anyway, I just had to say that. Thank you.
Well, that actually raises some really interesting questions about the history of sexuality and religion, which is indeed fascinating. Unfortunately, for me and my research in the topic, most of the really interesting stuff occurred in prehistory. By the time writing was invented, religion was by and large patriarchal, and you only had the official male view of deity, divinity, and male-female roles. But we know from archaeological evidence that dating back a few thousand more years from before the invention of writing. There certainly were fertility cults in which all of the religious iconography is, or the dominant religious iconography at least, is of female deities. And there's certain residual evidence that can be found in pre-industrial cultures that never ran into either Asiatic or Western civilization, in the Pacific Islands, for instance, where both male and female deities are found living in harmony in their cosmology of things. And you have matriarchal societies which, to whom the idea of women as inferior creatures is simply preposterous. Anyways, this is, I think, a long way from where the course is trying to take us here. But it's certainly very interesting stuff in terms of how the predominant religions we'll be familiar with today, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, for instance, and even to a substantial extent Buddhism, are really influenced by that, by the agricultural revolution and the patriarchal dominance in religion that followed it at the dawn of history, about the time writing was invented, that have cast female sexuality, have made it basically suspect, because females have some kind of mysterious power over men, and so they have to be controlled. And in patriarchal cultures, basically, they're treated in law the same way cattle are treated. That men have rights, and women and children are owned by men. And if they're not, they're essentially non-persons at all. They're without status, without identity, almost without humanity before the law. Okay. Marie, yeah. You've got your hand up again. All right. Here you go.
Well, Doug, actually, and all, I do see a full circle, and this is purposeful and useful. This to me is actually a beautiful community course meeting of A Course in Miracles, and it allows blocks to rise up for people and to share from a loving space, freely and openly. So it's really beautiful. I want to say this, that as you know, I have an experience where I have a friend who's a Native American. So I wanted to know, I asked him middle last year to tell me how he was taught what God is, and asked a number of questions. And there are a couple of interesting things really came to me. And it was very helpful with the course, and things that were always inside of me anyway, as a way to release from form and the attachment to form in terms of religion, and formal religion. And it was very, very helpful to me. And what he said was that the Garden of Eden story is in the, you know, in the 13 tribes, if you would, that goes back 20,000 years. He said, you know, it's really funny that as people, you know, dig stuff up, oh, this is 1,000 BC, oh, we find this 2,000 BC, oh, we find these tablets 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. And he says, you know, the stories that have been passed down from my ancestors, you know, have always been there. He says, people don't want to hear this, they only want to go by what they find in the tablets. But the oral tradition has always been there, including the Garden of Eden story. And it's almost the same without all, you know, all the frills, as the way it shows up in the Bible. That story has always been there. And the other thing that he said was that, you know, I said, So how is God? How do you explain, you know, what do you have to say about God? He said it is simply this. You know, God is of everything. And so it's like, wow. 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 Well, but how, you know, where does man get up on his feet? You know, that's a question. I don't know. When do they pinpoint that man gets up on his feet and starts communicating? That I don't know. But anyway, you know, I just loved it when he said God is of everything. And he basically was saying that even, because I was saying to him, there is no ego, there is no ego. And, you know, even that is used, is where I've ultimately come to, where perhaps in spirit and in soul and in truth, there is no ego. But even the egoic thought system is totally used. And the last thing I'll say is that he was given a word, which means one. And I thought that was really beautiful. But it helped me to see, yes. Oh, I think that's actually, he said it. God is in all things. And everywhere, you're right. In all things and everywhere. That was it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it made it really simple. I guess this need to put down books, you know, and study and research. I don't need the details is what I'm being shown, is that all of that has always been right there. The form isn't going to set me free. But I think this is a really interesting discussion. I think it's a very useful discussion to, you know, whenever we're reading the course, to allow whatever shows up. Anyway, thank you for letting me share, and thank you all for sharing. It's truly, truly appreciated. And I do feel the experience of love right here in this communion.
Well, thank you, Marie. This is actually becoming really quite interesting and relates to some research I did about 20 years ago on the history of religion. And one thing that is probably worth noting in terms of the Native American, and that would be North American, Central American theology, traditional theology is actually quite a bit different, but North American theology, insofar as we know anything about it, would be characterized by theologians as animist. And that's basically the oldest form of religious consciousness that we know of. It shows up in some places in Asia, in Japan, in the Pacific Islands, and in North America, pre-civilization, pre-Western contact. And in that, in animist theology, basically sees divinity in everything, in the wind, in the trees, in the grass, in the river. Everything is perceived as animated by a spirit, a supernatural energy or entity. In other words, God is in everything and everywhere. And when 16th and 17th century Western Christians encountered animists, they thought, oh, it's polytheism, which of course it isn't. And they felt it was inimical to their idea of one single God, the monotheistic notions of Christianity, and did everything they could to suppress these religions, considering it demonic. Yet, if you if you look closely at the course, you find an awful lot of resonance with certain animistic themes in terms of God is in, see the face of Christ in every living thing. God is in everything because God is in my mind. Yes. God is even in the wastebasket. So there is then a supernatural or divine animation or animism or aspect to everything that comes into perception, which is, I mean, you know, it's a textbook example of animist theology, which I found quite interesting when I read it. You also find echoes of animism in both Islamic and Jewish mysticism, and even in some Christian mysticism, where, I mean, there are hymns, Protestant hymns, venerable old Protestant hymns, that speak of God being perceived in thunderstorms and trees and clouds and roses and being directly experienced in those encounters with natural phenomenon. Marie, you've got your hand up again. All right. Take it away.
Yeah, Doug, what my friend explained to me, like you were saying, you see traces of this in other cultures, because what it was explained to me was because part of the Garden of Eden story was actually that it wasn't the way like with male and female, it was like the 13 tribes left Eden and spread around the world. And so in every culture, like, and I don't remember, he gave me the examples of what tribes went to what parts of the physical world, as we term it. So, yeah, you're going to see the essence of that in absolutely every single culture based on the Eden story given that way. It's beautiful. And if you could post that word for me, Doug, I would appreciate it. Anna something. I never heard it, but I certainly understand what you're saying, but I'd like to look up the term. Animus? Oh, thank you. Here's the mic. Thank you.
Okay, Carmen, you have something to contribute here. Here's the mic.
I'm sorry for the delay, but I'd like to kind of bring it back around to the topic of sex for just a second. I think this talk about the suppression of the female aspect of God and the idea that sex is a sort of a universal sin in the eyes of Christianity is something that's kind of important and pertinent to a later topic on homosexuality. I think if you keep in mind this subliminal hostility to women that is a factor, at the very least, in a lot of Christianity, it helps you to understand the animosity toward homosexuals, particularly gay men. And if you understand that a feminized man is somehow blending the two energies, the male and the female, in a way that is threatening to a very patriarchal view of what's good, then I think it helps you to understand. I think Jesus is really trying to dredge up some really deep stuff here that we don't acknowledge. And I think it's pertinent, and I just wanted to put that out there. If you hold that in mind, that the feminine is considered somehow negative. In fact, it comes down to us in numerology as one is positive because it's masculine, and two is feminine, therefore it's a negative number. There are so many ways that this pervades our minds at a subliminal level, and homosexuality, I believe, plays into that, at least the animosity towards it. So if we could keep that in mind, I think it's about Jesus trying to bring us back to an understanding of the equality of the two aspects, the two energies that we see throughout the physical universe, the male and the female, the negative and the positive, as we term them, and the negative connotation of the negative. So just if you could keep that in mind, I think it helps you to understand why Jesus even addresses homosexuality. And I think that, being pertinent to Bill Thetford especially, could be seen as personal, but I think it has a much broader application if we understand that he's addressing all of it and saying that homosexuality is not inherently bad except in having this slight tendency towards more body identification, which all of my gay friends who've read the Urtext have acknowledged is a part of their culture. But to just understand that feminizing of the masculine is very threatening to a patriarchal worldview. Thank you.
I just want to jump in there and comment on what Carmen just said, Marie. I'll give you the mic in a minute. In regard to the commentary or discussion of homosexuality in the Urtext, amongst others, Ken Wapnick has described it as essentially gay bashing, and therefore it had to have come from Helen and represent her opinions rather than something from Jesus. And he asked me, can you imagine Jesus gay bashing? And when I read it, I didn't think it was gay bashing at all. And like you, I showed that material to several gay friends, none of whom regarded it as gay bashing, and all of whom conceded that yes, the tendency towards more body identification than heterosexuality was true. Some of them thought it was a regrettable fact, but they conceded it was a fact and didn't respond with any degree of offense or feeling that they were being misunderstood or misrepresented. Okay, Marie, you've had your hand up for a while. Here you go.
This is beautiful, and it's coming back around to what you were reading from the Course. I want to say two things. One about what was coming to mind. At some point, I had a conversation with Dove that just really, really made sense to me. I don't even remember the whole conversation. But it was something, I guess, it was just like a validation of something that was already there in my mind. And, you know, I had posted, I am both. and Dove had said, and I think there's even a term for it, but Dove said, you know, everyone has aspects of male and female in them. And in each one, it's seemingly a different distribution. And that was like, wow. You know, it was like, it just made it. And there is a term for that. What's the term for that, Dove? Androgyny. Oh, and that was so useful to me. No, Lisa, that's not that. It was so useful to me having very strong aspects of both, but a lot of guilt about, if you would, my male energies. about the intellect and arguing with males, and I made up a dream of, you know, coming to a family with six brothers. Now, regarding, so that was really, that was very, very useful to me, to see that. And in that way, you know, with that word alone, regarding the aspects of self, you know, the aspects of male and female within one, as I recognize that everybody has some of both, you know, in that way I can truly see innocence, you know, and it's really beautiful. Thank you, Doug, for that. And I can see them as a perfect creation, you know. Anyway, the other thing, coming back to, yes, there are a lot of times in the text, I see it more and more, it does seem like it's Helen, and, you know, going back to that line that we were talking about, where it says, can be, what was it, displaced outward in sex, you know, I had to ask the questions myself to friends that have chosen homosexuality as a lifestyle, and it was very useful to me to see that. Thank you. That's very helpful now, Doug. That there are some there are scientists that want to say, well, they were born that way. That's just the way it is. And there's some that say, well, it's an inability to reconcile, like all the stuff that Carmen was talking about. And the reality is that it's both. Not, I'm saying for each individual, but I'm saying both experiences are experiences that are valid, that you'd have to ask an individual, and they may not know, but some are very, very clear that their, if you would, propensity for sexual with the same sex was there, you know, from very, 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 very little. And there are others that perhaps, I can't speak for anyone else, I do not make this decision for anyone else, but it can be a displacement outward. It can be a projection based on, you know, a separated thought, an unreconciled thought about sex or parents, whatever. Yeah, I'm not talking about whether or not sex in and of itself is innocent or not. Like everything, everything is neutral. Anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Well, thank you for your contribution, Marie. Our reading is at the top of page 36. T1B37AE, and this has to do with the confusion between miracle and sexual impulses, and I think it's really quite relevant to what we're talking about. Do you want to carry on reading, Deborah?
Hi, I'm ready. So, 37AE, the confusion of miracle impulse with sexual impulse is a major source of perceptual distortion because it induces rather than straightening out the basic level confusion which underlies all those who seek happiness with the instruments of the world. A desert is a desert is a desert. You can do anything you want in it, but you cannot change it from what it is. It still lacks water. which is why it is a desert. Bracket, bring up that dream about the bluebird. While Helen Shuckman was looking for this dream, she came across another. The message was to bring both as an example, an excellent example of how extremely good Helen Shuckman had become over the intervening 25 years at sharpening pencils, or the intervening 25 years at sharpening pencils. Note that the essential content hasn't changed. It's just better written. Close bracket. The thing to do with a desert is to leave. Here you go, Doug.
Okay, I just wanted to comment. Those two dreams being discussed here, while we do have in the notes some of Helen's dream diaries, I don't believe we have either of those. I've not been able to identify anything in what I've seen of her dream diaries that connects to either of those. All I know about them is what it says here, that it has to do with the 25 years at sharpening pencils, or 25 years at perfecting the means without paying apt attention to the ends. But the thing to do with the desert is leave, which is an interesting metaphor. That's a very interesting paragraph. anybody else want to make a comment on it? Otherwise, the next paragraph is from the shorthand notes. Actually, the next seven paragraphs are from the shorthand notes and were not copied into the urtext. And okay, Deborah, take it away. This would be T1B37AE, notes insert 1 on page 36 at that URL.
Marie, did you want me to read that again? 37AE? Is that what you're talking about? Okay, I can do that. So 37AE on page 36. Use my paper. The confusion of miracle impulses with sexual impulse is a major source of perceptual distortion because it induces rather than straightening out the basic level confusion which underlies all those who seek happiness with the instruments of the world. A desert is a desert is a desert. You can do anything you want to it, but you cannot change it from what it is. It still lacks water, which is why it is a desert. Bracket, bring up that dream about the bluebird. While Helen Shuckman was looking for this dream, she came across another. The message was to bring both as an excellent example of how extremely good Helen Shuckman had become over the intervening 25 years at sharpening pencils. Note that this essential content hasn't changed. It's just better written. Close bracket. The thing to do with a desert is to leave it. 37AEN1. This is all in double brackets all the way down to the bottom of 37AEN4. So inside those double brackets, there's brackets. So I'm just going to announce those. Bracket. Esther called to that Dave Diamond died. Maybe that was his way of leaving the desert. Dave loved Esther and Annie Gold and the children he taught. I don't know about his own children, but I do know, in brackets from Esther, that he doesn't get along with Terry. A while back, she told me that Dave would not let her into the room and kept telling her to get out. And she just hung around all day in the hallway or the lounge nearby. I went into the room, understand instructions. That was in forget the name of those brackets. Square brackets, and spoke to Dave, who was very groggy. Every time he opened his eyes, I said, quotations, we all love you, so don't be afraid, close quotations. Not allowed. I prayed that he would be able to love everybody in return. Square brackets was, two was under instruction. Now, there's a hyphen in there, in hyphen instruction. I was going to look up more about that, but didn't have a chance to. So I don't know if you have anything on that, Doug, when I complete this little area. Close square bracket. Having been told, square bracket, I think on great authority, close square bracket, that his only real danger came from lack of this connection, close bracket. 37 AEN2. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, I just want to make some contextual comments on here for people who haven't been with us in recent weeks. In this period, which would be November of 1965, Helen's friend of Helen's by the name of Dave Diamond was in hospital and terminally ill. And periodically she discusses visits with him. She prays for his healing. And this is one more example of what Esther had just called a colleague, I presume, of both of them to say that Dave had died. And then maybe this was his way of leaving the desert, which is an interesting observation. Further observations about other people, Terry, Arnie, we come across Amy later, people, I don't know their connection to Helen. So I can't really offer any insight onto what precisely these personnel, what role these personalities might have played in Helen's life. So she's also saying here that she's going to his hospital room. He's groggy but somewhat conscious. She's praying for him, speaking for him, and perceives herself to be under instructions. Twice she mentions under instructions, and then having been told, in brackets, I think on great authority, capitalized, indicating that would be God's authority, that his only real danger came from lax in this connection, which was his ability to love everybody in return. That was that connection. So that brings us to the second paragraph of notes insert, T1B37AEN2. And go ahead, Deborah.
I didn't visit him this Friday, but I am sure this was right, because I was very careful to ask. I was going over to after the lecture and was told not to. Perhaps there was no quotations need to know, close quotations involved. AEN3. I am upset about it and am leaving my notes for a while. I think I'd rather pay just more. 37N4. Doug, here you go.
Okay, that last line, I think I'd rather pay just more. That's what it says in the notes. Maybe it was meant to be pray, I don't know. There's clearly some kind of a problem with it. And Helen is telling us she's upset at the point she's writing this, and so she's going to put down her writing for a while. In the previous paragraph, she mentions that she was going to visit on Friday, but felt she was being told not to. And perhaps, and that I think was exactly the point where David had died, and perhaps there was no need to know involved, which is in quotes. And that I think refers to an earlier statement by Jesus to Helen that she would be told everything she needed to know, and that information on the need to know basis did not originate with the CIA. And there's certainly many who have experienced that the Holy Spirit does tend to communicate to us on a need-to-know basis. We're not told anything more than we need to know at the moment we need to know it. Partly, I think, because if I knew any more than what I need to know, my ego would just have too much fun with it and twist it all out of shape, and it would be less than useless. It would be quite confusing. So those two points I wanted to mention, and now we move into more personal references with Terry, who I'm thinking might have been Dave's wife, perhaps. I don't know. But Terry was talking about giving away the baby, and I don't know whose baby this was, except perhaps Terry's, or why she wanted to give it away. And Helen proceeds to talk about her reactions to that transaction. In T1B37AE N4.
Esther said Terry was talking about giving away the baby. I jumped to the conclusion that I was supposed to take her, but that may easily be indiscriminate miracle impulse. I think I'd better just stop now. Close bracket. That's really awesome, showing that Helen is really careful and discerning about what miracle impulse she's following. Is she really following the miracle impulse? And we can always get told again, which is really nice that Helen has this in her notes and we're able to read it. I find that's nice. 37AE N5. I prayed for Dave and said that whatever miracles I could do for him, even now, or any of his family, I would will to do. I also asked Jesus to help Dave with the course. Then I was told to go in and just visit with Jonathan and pray for him, particularly if he was asleep, which he was. It was the only time so far I prayed intensively for him. When this happens, I am strongly aware that I am not praying alone. We told Jonathan that he should forget about the Alexandrian Library and all the rest because it didn't matter. He showed a lot of love this time and should claim his forgiveness. He does not need to hurt himself and must stop these symptoms of disequilibrium and establish his freedom. He woke up and he said he was feeling better but hungry. 37AE N6. I was going to wash my hair after, there's missing words in there, fixing his dinner, but I was told to visit his mother. I'm not too enthusiastic about this, but I'm going now. 37AE N7. Doug, take it away.
I don't know if anybody else is having the problem, but there's words dropping out. The net is stealing words from you, Deborah. In my ears, anyways. That last line was, I was told to go visit his mother. And I'm not too enthusiastic about this, but going now. It's interesting, just another sort of biographical contextual note. Jonathan, of course, refers to, is the name Helen used for her husband, Louis. And there's this comment about the Alexandrian Library, and she and Jesus, we, told Jonathan he should forget about it. Now, Louis was, I believe, a used book, an antique book dealer. And so the Alexandrian Library, which was created, I think, in the... but destroyed by Julius Caesar in 50... It was created by Alexander in 330 BC, was destroyed by Julius Caesar in 40 BC, I think, was this enormous repository of ancient literature, hundreds of thousands of scrolls burned, lost, and with it much of the history of the previous three millennia, much of the recorded history. And I find it interesting that that should be mentioned. It's certainly understandable how Louis would have an interest in it, but he's being told he should forget about it. It didn't matter. Which I thought was interesting. And now we're down to the last paragraph of this particular insertion from the notes, which is at the bottom of page 36. T1B37AE N7. Take it away, Deborah.
It occurred to me while waiting for the elevator that I was glad I was going, because it was a way of atoning to Jonathan for my being so nasty to him. Bracket. He is always happy to have me visit his mother, close bracket, and in a way of atoning for Dave, too. The impersonal nature of miracles is because atonement itself is one. Here you go, Doug.
I just wanted to comment that this entire section, we can understand why it was deleted, because it's not dictated material. It's basically Helen's commentary. She talks about some things that happened, some things that Jesus said. She talks about her experience of feeling when she's praying for Louis, she's not praying alone, which I think is very interesting and useful, but clearly it's not part of the dictation from Jesus. It's Helen's, essentially, it's a page of Helen's diary, which occurs simultaneously with the dictation in the early weeks. One of the reasons that makes it important is sometimes the dictation, and as you read the notes, it's quite visible, sentence by sentence within a paragraph, we alternate between Jesus dictating miracle principles and Helen commenting on them or asking him questions. And in some of the omitted material, a paragraph is struck, but apparently she didn't notice that within the middle of that paragraph there's some genuine dictation, including a couple of miracle principles that didn't make it even into the Ur text. Teddy has his hand up. All right. Here you go, Ted.
Can you guys hear me? I'm on a laptop, and I'm not sure if the mic works. So if somebody can hear me. Yes, okay. So, you know, the more I sort of read this material, especially the Ur text, and then when I began to read what Doug has made available recently, you know, I really, there were some understandings that I was given, and it was the nature of the communication that Jesus is actually having with Helen. And what I noticed more and more, and then it was verified by my, you know, the thing that sort of like guides me and gives me information, is that Jesus really is not talking to Helen, the personality, but he's talking directly to Helen as a soul, who he's been involved in a plan with since for a long time, prior to her going into this period of unconsciousness. And I don't think we know how many sort of like, I'll use this term, although, you know, it may not be entirely politically correct, how many lifetimes it took her to come back around to hearing his voice. So when he, and also the thing that I noticed is that while Helen has the, while we have these particular notes from Helen and the content of these dictations, Helen had actually been getting information and guidance long before she actually began to take notes, and long before we actually, you know, it's historically in her lifetime we have been given to know about. So one of the things that I think occurs, in especially that one about the Alexandrian library, is that a lot of stuff, when Jesus began to talk to Helen, your mind has to be particularly open to get this type of communication. So one of the things that began to happen for Helen, and this is just something I understand from my own sort of like communication, and also from what I've been given to understand about the relationship of Jesus and Helen, you know, one of the things that begins to happen is your mind begins to get open, and with an open mind that's unsealed and is not in the condition of fear, especially when you're in revelatory experiences, and according to the dictation, Helen had quite a number of revelatory experiences. When your mind is open in the revelatory state, there's all manner of memories that are made available to you and that you're open to, because your mind is sort of like capable of being everywhere and gleaming things that you can't glean in a condition of thinking linearly, or even in miraculous sort of like corrections. So I think one of the things that was going on was she would have these little bits and pieces that she was open to in revelatory moments that began to preoccupy her thinking such as like the Alexandrian Library. And Jesus was just sort of in a sense, comforting her and letting her know that he knew what was going on in her mind and trying to sort out for her the stuff that was useful in the plan that they were now enacting and getting rid of the need to understand things that may not necessarily be useful in this particular time frame wherein which they were making manifest what we know as A Course in Miracles. So when I've asked, that's sort of the understanding that I got. You know, a lot of things, and especially Helen's sound machine, you know, a lot of things, her mind was opened, and anybody who's undergone revelation, especially prolonged periods of revelation, understand that your mind goes all over and lights on all types of things. Now, not everything is useful within the plan. As Jesus says, there's experiences that we have that, you know, they may be, that are brought about from open-mindedness, but the experiences that are in line with the thinking, with the thought system of A Course in Miracles, are the one that Jesus wants to validate. So there were other experiences that Helen was having and memories that Jesus was remembering, because she was, in fact, a priestess in an earlier time and had knowledge and access to other things in that state of priestess mind. So there were other things that were breaking into her consciousness, into her awareness, and Jesus was helping to comfort her and let her know that they were valid things that she was remembering, but they were not useful and could possibly be a distraction in what they were here trying to accomplish.
Thank you for that, Teddy. Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. And there is plenty of evidence, anecdotal and some documentary, that Helen was, in fact, very much receiving or communicating, hearing the voice, long before she heard the words, "This is A Course in Miracles, please take notes." And we have some of her writing from the pre-course time. And we have other accounts from, predominantly from Bill Thetford, about sort of mystical experiences she told him about well before the course, years before the course first began coming. And I see Marie has her hand up. Here you go.
I'm really glad you're reading this stuff too, because before really reading, before you started bringing this stuff out, I don't have the Urtex and I haven't really been reading this stuff. I've read very little from, I have a version, but I have read very little. But I have had very strong, even before having an experience with Jesus, I had very strong experience with Helen last year as I was reading very often. And before I, you know, when you're reading this stuff right now, I'm just like laughing here saying, okay, let me just give you like my writing. It looks like Helen's in a lot of senses. But what's beautiful is that there's just so much beautiful, truly, that I see about Helen and Bill. What was coming to me about revelatory experiences, I don't know what you call them, revelatory experiences, direct experiences, they're not, it's not always like nice visions. When I was 18, I'm just going to say this, when I was 18, I came home and I told my family that everybody knew everything. Now, I got put in a psychiatric hospital for that. Okay? But truly, I knew that this was true. That this was in fact true. That all knowledge was within all mind. And I have had all kinds. I mean, I haven't written them all down, but I did have a very good guide, you know, when I wanted to pursue or study anything, that told me that I really didn't need to, you know, because there were people coming to me telling me that I should pursue this or pursue that. What were they telling me? I don't remember. But there's been a number of paths, and I had a very wise guide that basically said, keep it very simple. Just, you know, allow, what she said to me was, allow this, what seems to be supernatural, to be natural. I mean, you know, Cynthia was saying earlier, I see dead people. Yeah, that's normal. That's normal. I see souls. I see, you know, I've seen all kinds of things. And, you know, I don't know. I'm just, you know, a lot of my life I felt like a freak with these things. And I've tried to fit into a form that didn't make any sense to me. And one of the gifts, with A Course in Miracles for me is just that, that you know, that trust that the mind is purely abstract and all of these things are purely normal and natural. Yeah, I love all of you souls too. And that, you know, Helen wanted so much. The way it looks to me was to get it simple. Was to truly get it simple and be useful with everything that she's been given. And, you know, she and Bill did that. They really did that. He had the mind training experience and she had the heart. She really had the heart to show up and listen to the simplicity and be given a way to share it with all of us. I mean, it's just beautiful. She is a poetess. it was to come so beautifully. So anyway, thanks for letting me share that.
Well, thank you, Marie. And this brings us to back into the text, out of the notes now, at the bottom of page 37 on the combined document. And Deborah, if you can read T1B38, please. Thank you.
Miracles arise from a miraculous state of mind. By being one, the state of mind goes out to anyone, even without the awareness of the miracle worker himself. The impersonal nature of miracles is because atonement itself is one, uniting all creations with their creator. 39A. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to make a couple of comments on 2 points. The term impersonal has been applied to miracles and the miraculous state of mind or miracle-mindedness many times in the previous pages. And here we have kind of a definition, and we also have, we see the pattern of how this material is presented, that initially we get points kind of listed and then later those points will be referred back to with expansions, clarifications, and explanations, and sometimes examples. So miracles arise from a miraculous state of mind. By being one, this state of mind goes out to anyone, even without the awareness of the miracle worker himself. So no awareness is necessary here. This is the impersonal nature. It applies to all being, as opposed to revelations, which are described as intensely personal, a very personal connection between a soul and his creator or her creator. The impersonal nature of miracles is because the atonement itself is one. The atonement itself is one. It unites all creations with their creator. And if we look at that word, atonement, at one meant, and it really was coined from those three English terms, at one meant, by William Tyndale in 1527, when he couldn't find a good English word to translate the Greek word he was reading in the New Testament, and so he coined the word at one meant, which is almost a verb in the sense of there's a transition, there's a movement implied in it, that there is a uniting going on. The atonement is less of a noun than a verb. It's a uniting, the uniting of all creations with their creator, and by definition, with each other. And this is the impersonal nature. Which takes us to the last paragraph on page 36, T1B 39A. Deborah.
The miracle is an expression of our inner awareness of Christ and acceptance of his atonement. The mind is then in a state of grace and naturally becomes gracious, both to the host within and the stranger without. By bringing in the stranger, he becomes your brother. And now it's at page 37, 39B. The miracles you are told not to perform have not lost their value. They are still expressions of your own state of grace, but the action aspect of the miracle should be Christ-controlled. Doug, go ahead.
Okay, just for future reference, Deborah, when I put my hand up, finish the paragraph, and then let me babble. In this case, I wanted to comment on the previous paragraph. By bringing in the stranger, he becomes your brother, which I believe is a reference to Matthew 25:35, where Jesus is quoted as saying, "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in." And then goes on to say, whatever you do for the least of these, my brethren, you do also unto me, expressing the idea of the essential oneness between God and all creations, including the Christ or Jesus himself. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that one, and I think we better start that paragraph 39B, top of page 37 again, because this is a really important paragraph about indiscriminate miracles. And I'm just going to comment that first line, the miracles you are told not to perform have not lost their value. And that is later, in later versions, is reworded to the miracles you are not told to perform, rather than told not. And there's quite a difference between those two phraseologies. If I'm not told to perform it, well, I'm not told anything. If I'm told not to perform it, then that's something a little different. But in the notes and the air text, it's clearly not to perform, told not to perform, and emphasized, the not being emphasized. And so I will let you read that one. Deborah, top of page 37.
Okay, so we're at 39B. The miracles you are told not to perform have not lost their value. They are still expressions of your own state of grace. But the action aspect of the miracle should be Christ-controlled because of his complete awareness of the whole plan. The impersonal nature of miracle-mindedness ensures your own grace, but only Christ is in a position to know where grace can be bestowed. Take it away, Doug.
Okay, I want to just emphasize the repetition of the impersonal nature of miracle-mindedness being stressed again. And the miracles you have are told not to perform have not lost their value. Well, as I understand this distinction between personal and impersonal, if I have a personal connection with someone and am personally moved to help a friend with a broken leg, for instance, because of my personal connection and empathy, then that's not a legitimate miracle impulse necessarily, because the miracle impulse would be impersonal in nature. And my desire to help my friend, for instance, could really get in my way of understanding Christ control or asking, should I act in this situation? I want to, but that's me wanting to. That's not necessarily Jesus or Christ saying, yes, this would be a good action in the name of the sonship to perform for this person at this time. Could be that attempting to do a miracle in that situation would only frighten the person and chase them away. I can't know. Christ can, which is why the miracle needs to be Christ-controlled. So in that sense, I have already been told not to perform any miracle except having asked and been told to do it. And this is one of the reasons I believe the original form of this statement is correct, because we have just been told what miracles we have been told in the previous 36 pages, what miracles we are to perform and under what circumstances, and how we are to go about consulting, and what miracles not to perform, which is to say, not to respond to that personal sense of concern, but to respond rather to the higher level of Christ control. Yet, we are told that even in that situation, they are still expressions of your own state of grace, but the action aspect is where the complication arises, because they need to be Christ-controlled because of his complete awareness of the whole plan. I only know what I'm told on my own need-to-know basis. Jesus knows the whole picture, so I have to trust him to tell me where a miracle should be acted upon, when a miracle impulse should be acted upon. And we have some hands up here, so just pointing out that we've only got 13 minutes left in our slot. Who's ever had their hand up first, take it away.
All right, I'm very aware of the time, and I will keep this brief. What I love about this part is that if I am so focused on what it's supposed to look like to perform the miracle, I miss the big picture. And the big picture is there's always a miracle. My intent, my focus, my ability to be connected and to be Christ-controlled, that I have to realize that my wanting to get up ahead of the game and wanting to do something that I think should be done in that way, like you were saying, gets in my way and could get in the other person's way. But just the fact that I'm there with the other person, in itself, there is stuff going on that I'm not even aware of, that a miracle is never lost, that the presence of being there with even just that intent of awareness and love and grace is in itself doing more than I could possibly even know. And so if I am so focused in on what I think needs to happen and am wanting to come from that perspective, I might miss that for myself and get in the way temporarily for the other person to hear it as well. But what's really awesome about this is that In this, there is a certain type of discipline that ends up coming about, because if I am looking to be Christ-controlled, if I'm looking for all of it to be Christ-controlled, I will be consistently tuned into knowing which way to go, what to do, instead of saying, oh, you know, this is what I remember this one, this is how this should be. And even though normally, in many other cases, this particular miracle would be a definite green light, in this case, it's not. But it is very, 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 very important that I realize that just because I am getting prompted to not perform that miracle in that specific situation, that it does do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is nothing wrong with doing that miracle. It is just that it has to be guided and directed by Christ. That it cannot be coming. It's not indiscriminate. It is very important that it needs to be Christ controlled. So it is very this particular part has been very good in my experience with the Holy Spirit, because when I would be in a situation, I definitely needed to be pulled back several times in a way that I didn't understand. And at first, what I got was that one of the reasons why this was happening was so that I would listen to and follow the guidance above all and first and foremost. So anyway, so thanks for letting me share that.
Well, thanks for sharing that, and I quite agree. I think that is what this material is attempting to explain to us. And I think the explanation, if it's carefully read and considered in its complete form, is really quite clear. In the next paragraph, 40A, explains it in somewhat greater detail. Now, Christian, you had your hand up there. Did you want to say something at this point? Okay, here you go.
I had nothing much to add, actually, except for that it just came to me in a flash. It was pretty much what Lisa said, but it was kind of like this, that it's really funny. If you think you're going to do something, you know, whether you call it a miracle or fix a problem or whatever, that is like a million times slower than the understanding of the Christ in you. It's so slow. It's indescribable. It's like, you know, when people talk about slow time in this world, you know, or as opposed to a quickening or something, I don't know. So the idea that you think from that level, from your thinking and reasoning, oh, there's a problem over there. I'm not talking about assisting someone with a broken leg, giving them a bandage. And then the Christ in you can also perform the miracle at the same time. But the part of you that the personality and the consciousness that he's talking about in conscious control really hasn't got a clue about miracles. And what I was getting is that when the Christ in you performs a miracle, it's so fast. It's so funny that Paul's writing about speeds there. I like to go fast. That's what I was getting from the Holy Spirit, that it's way, way more rapid, and it understands far more than your conscious mind could ever process. It might get a glimpse, but basically it won't be aware of it, because that part of your mind is so incredible, it couldn't slow down enough to bandage broken legs or whatever. So what that's why they're not consciously chosen is because the consciousness would see a problem and attempt to fix it, whereas the Christ in you would see a problem, know it's not real, and change the appearance. So that's what just came to me. Thanks. Otherwise, it was just basically what Lisa said. That's why I put down my hand. Thank you. Nice to see you, Douglas. I see you have a good reader today, much more professional than Christian Passy.
Yes, my regular reader is back from Vancouver Island, and it is, yeah, it's a real treat to have such competence present. Okay, Deborah, we got 6 minutes left, and I think we can do this next paragraph, and it's an important one, and it really concludes the section. T1B40A. I think we should probably, this will be our last paragraph for today. The next paragraph is, I want to finish the instructions about sex, because this is an area the miracle worker must understand, and that will be next week's beginning point. But right now, let's wind up the miracle with its rather interesting conclusion. T1B40A, towards the bottom of page 37. Take it away, Deborah.
A miracle is never lost. It touches many people you may not even know, and sometimes produces undreamed of changes in forces of which you are not even aware. This is not your concern. It will also always bless you. This is not your concern either, but it is the concern of the record. The record is completely unconcerned with reliability, being perfectly valid because of the way it was set up. It always measures what it was supposed to measure. Shall I go on? Go ahead, Doug.
No, I don't think we should go on now, because the next paragraph opens an entirely new topic, and we've only got 5 minutes left. Now, we have here this word record. If we take that last two sentences out, we've got an interesting instruction. The miracle is never lost. It touches many people you may not even know, and sometimes produces undreamed of changes in forces of which you are not even aware. And that's not your concern. It's not. It's not my concern. It's not our concern. That's up to Christ. It will also always bless you, but that's not your concern either. I mean, we don't do miracles to earn blessings. We don't do anything out of love in order to get. It's not a trading action, and miracles are always an expression of love. Love is a gift. It's not a tendering of currency in the expectation of some return. But then we have these last three sentences, very interesting and very sort of out of character with most of what else is in the course. But it is the concern of the record. The record is completely unconcerned with reliability, relating back to that previous reliability validity discussion, being perfectly valid because of the way it was set up. It always measures what it was supposed to measure. Now, I would again really like to know what Helen understood from this term. The best I can come up with is that this is a reference to the Akashic record, that notion that everything that ever happens or ever will happen or ever has happened is in some way encoded and recorded somewhere, such that every imbalance ends up getting rebalanced. The notion can be associated with karma and forgiveness, in that forgiveness cancels karma. It can be related to that notion of, for every action there is a reaction, what goes around comes around. There's many ways of understanding it. Lisa has her hand up, and you got 2 minutes, Lisa.
Okay. What I was getting from this was that when Jesus talks about the purification process, and he talks about how the Holy Spirit will take whatever it is that is totally not based on truth and completely discard it, and what is completely based on truth and keep it, and what is partially based on truth, purify it. It's not concerned with, it's concerned only with validity. And so by concerned only with validity, it will take the truth and it keeps it. And what is said in, Jesus says in the Course, is that stores it, brings it, keeps it for it in the kingdom. And that all of the things that we all of it we've created, extended, and shared is kept for us, and that is the record, that is the truth. You know, it doesn't use the word record, but that's, to me, it feels exactly the same. So only what is valid. And so it doesn't matter, because as long as I'm focused on the miracle, as long as I'm focused on healing my mind, everything else just falls away because it wasn't even really there. And that's why it's completely unconcerned with anything else but just the validity. That's it. So that's what it really speaks to for me. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And I actually might start next week with a review of that paragraph, because there's a number of very interesting potential connotations to that particular phrase, and I'd be interested to know what anyone's perceptions or observations on that are. And on that note, I'm going to say goodbye to everybody and thank you all for being here. It's 6 o'clock and our slot is over, and I want to give Deborah 30 seconds to say goodbye too. I love you all. Thank you. It's been fantastic, your commentary tonight, and I hope to have this up, the recording up on the net within a few days. God bless you all.
Hey guys, you're filling me up, man. This is fantastic. So all my love to everybody. Thanks very much. Bye.
I just want to say, I don't know whether Dub's here, but it just struck me as really funny. The Holy Spirit was just saying to me, it's kind of like, the amazing thing is we can discuss this in intellectual terms. That's the difficult bit. The easy bit is performing the miracles, because the Christ in us is the real and natural bit. The miracle is that we can communicate this in words. And that's the bit that we actually struggle with. The actual transmission of the miracle and the light is absolutely effortless. Thank you.